tried to speak like a prince, to be received like one. A voice spoke back.
"We are sorry for our tardiness. The king does not reside here, and it took time for word of your arrival to reach us. We are as apologetic as Geirrod, when to Odin he did refuse the gift of mead."
"Didn't Geirrod fall on his sword?" said Bragi under his breath.
"Your words are sweet as Eden's apples," said Vali. "We greet you, Heming's men, brave Spear-Danes and sons of honour."
Vali was now face to face with the man who had first blocked his path. The warrior was richly dressed, a gold brooch glinting like another candle in the dark, and at his waist a fine sword, its scabbard picked out in gemstones. He was tall and thin, and by his bearing a formidable warrior.
"I am Skardi, son of Rolf," said the man. "Trusted adviser to Heming the Great, foe of the Franks and protector of the Danes. He who takes tribute from 8 kingdoms, and whose glory shall last until the gods destroy us."
"I am Vali, son of Othon the Pitiless, scourge of the north, most feared lord in this middle earth. I am ward to Forkbeard, king of the Rigir, whose name resounds everywhere beneath the skull of the sky god."
Vali glanced to his left. Bragi had the wolfman by the arm and was speaking into his ear. Feleg's eyes were wild as they had been at the slave market, and he looked ready to attack. Vali remembered what he had thought of berserks the first time he had seen them operate, and wondered how he had found himself with this man, next to whom the followers of the cult of Odin seemed models of restraint.
"Forgive my retainer," said Vali. "He seeks only to protect me in a strange land."
Skardi pursed his lips.
"Tell him he will find my men harder work than any slaver. They have fed the eagles until they are too fat to fly."
Reports of the slaver's death had clearly reached Heming's court. There was nothing to do but stick with his original plan. How long would he have before word from Rogaland arrived? A month at the most, maybe a lot less. If Heming detained him too long, then his future looked very uncertain.
"Our bearing and our deeds shall cause those birds to starve," said Vali. "We come as friends, with kind words and respect for your far-famed king."
"Then welcome, friends. Allow us to bring you to the halls of our High Lord."
The two men embraced, and this seemed to calm Feleg.
"We have a boat at the river's mouth. If you would do us the honour of accompanying us," said Skardi.
Vali knew this was hard hospitality, the sort that will not be refused. They set off through the dark streets. Vali became aware that he was accompanied by at least 40 men. He was a prisoner, no mistaking it.
"You arrived by fishing boat, prince. It's a strange choice for a king's son. Has Forkbeard no Draka to transport you?"
"My lord," said Vali, "we were shipwrecked on the wide islands. A storm came from nowhere, a creation no doubt of the sorceress Harik. Our gifts for your lord were lost, but so important was our mission that we continued as we could."
Vali knew it was a risk to appear vulnerable. A real man would spit at a storm and land his ship safe, or at least that was what the skalds said. Despite this, Vali had heard of enough heroes who had gone to the bottom, though few in coastal waters.
Skardi was thoughtful. "And the purpose of your mission?" "Why, peace, my lord, peace! Now Forkbeard and my father sit with 80 drakas ready to send a sword storm to Harik. Once the fire of battle lights, it may not be easy to put out, nor to confine it to one land. I need your king's word that he will not interfere as we take our rightful revenge and raise a spear din in Harik's halls."
Vali had lost face over the shipwreck. Now he tried to regain it with talk of war. Skardi gave a curt nod, giving away nothing.
"Our Drakkar," he said, "is waiting."
Chapter 29. The Drum.
Drown. Drown. Just drown. Stop fighting. Just drown.
Adisla willed herself to sink, but couldn't do it. She was too good a swimmer, and her body insisted on trying to survive even in that cold swell. There was shouting from the ship. The sail peeled back, and men were pointing at her and yelling through the rain. The man in the four-cornered hat was there, and had a drum in his hand. He began to beat it and to sing. Adisla wanted to swim away from the boat, but her instinct for preservation was too strong, and she simply trod water, pumping her legs while willing her body to go under. Her skirts had filled with water and were heavy now, constrictive and tiring.
"Freya, take me! Freya, take me!"
She lost sight of the ship. Then she lost sight of everything and knew she was sinking. Still she tried to breathe, but choked. Then she was thrashing wildly, desperate to get up to the surface, desperate for air, her body moving to the demands of instinct, not thought. But Adisla couldn't find the air. It was as if a giant hand was holding her down, irresistible, pushing her into darkness while her arms flailed for the light. Her lungs were bursting, and she couldn't help but try to breathe in again. And then it was calm and it was light, and her mind wandered. She thought she was with Vali again, by the fjord on a hot, sunny day. And they were laughing. The light weakened and dimmed, and she realized she wasn't outside at all, but in a cave whose floor was submerged in water. There was something in there, a presence that seemed to bubble from the darkness, a formless animosity all around her. But when she looked, it was only Vali, and he was saying, "Wait for me. I will find you. I am looking." But it wasn't Vali. It was the Wolfman. She reached out to touch him, but then there was pain and there was light and screaming, and underneath it all a strange chant and the beat of a drum that she knew came from the odd man who had sat next to her on the ship. She didn't understand his words at all, nor did she like their sound. To her ears it was like a dog singing, rough and guttural. But inside her something stirred, and she moved her arms, kicked off her skirts, and struck out for the ship. The water seemed immense and strong, but the beat from the ship seemed to sustain her, and her movements became calm and purposeful, even as she wept, because she couldn't drown. A rope was in her hands, and then arms were reaching down for her. She was hauled back onto the ship, wearing only her pinafore and leggings. There was a face above her, the man in the blue coat and four-pointed hat. He had a drum in his hands, marked with strange symbols. The red on the band of his hat seemed terribly vivid to her. The man leaned towards her, pushed back her head, and held his ear to her mouth. When he heard her breathe, he took the cloak Adisla had discarded when she had gone overboard and put it around her. Then he hugged her to him to make her warm, holding her and whispering to her in his strange language. The Danes shot her lascivious glances, but the man's eyes kept them at bay. They were pale blue, the color of cold sky, and the contrast with his dark hair was striking. Not a man in the crew doubted he was a sorcerer. Adisla was coughing and shaking and frozen. There was an uncommon depth to the cold she felt. Whatever she had sensed in that cave had been real to her, and meant her no good. But she had seen only Vali and Feleg, who she knew were her protectors. The sorcerer crawled away down the ship, and came back with a water skin. She put it to her lips and drank. The magician's face was only just visible in the dim light beneath the sail. He grinned at her, and she started. His teeth were filed to points, like an animal's. He leaned towards her and said in halting Norse,
"Do not hurry to that place, lady. You will go there again quickly enough."
Chapter 30 Politics. The sun shone brightly on Vali during his time at Hemming's court, but he knew things were going badly for him when the king didn't receive him immediately. It was a week before he was summoned to the main hall, a week in which he stayed in the longhouse he had been allocated in case he should bump into the monarch outside his halls. He knew that the meeting had to be on Hemming's terms, at the time and place of his choosing. So when the summons came, it was welcome, a relief from boredom and the frustration of inaction, at least. Vali went alone. It felt good to get out into the clean air after a week in the smoky house, and he took the opportunity to look around. Hemming's settlement was impressive, containing 5 big longhouses. There were ramparts, one with a gate, on every side of the settlement, apart from that adjoining the winding sea inlet, or river, as it now was. A smaller version of the sea wall being constructed at Heithabir extended from the rampart into the water in a semicircle with a chain across the entrance from the river. Vali didn't know whether to marvel at the skill of its construction, or despair at how difficult it would make escape. There were only a couple of lookouts on the sea wall, but, thought Vali, how many does it take to raise an alarm? No ship could come or go unless the chain was lowered, and if Vali and his companions tried to escape over land, Hemming would simply alert the surrounding farms. A jarl in a bright yellow tunic conducted him to the hall, a huge structure with bulging sides like a ship's. You could have fitted 2 of Forkbeard's halls inside it. A door was opened, and he went in. At the far end he could just see through the haze of the fire a tall, thin man sitting on a large stone seat. As Vali was led forward, he saw the king more clearly. He was richly dressed in bright blue silks, his eyes elaborately decorated with kohl, and his lips smeared with the juice of berries. Kneeling at his side was the drab figure of a Christian priest, his head shaved into a tonsure. He was scribbling on a tablet, and Vali would normally have been intrigued to look at what he was doing. On Hemming's other side was a pretty woman in a long silk gown of pale yellow. She came forward to Vali with a drinking horn. It was a beautiful thing, polished and inlaid with silver. The woman spoke in an exotically accented Norse.
"I am Inga, Queen of the Danes, and I bid you welcome to our court. Drink, guest. Accept the mead of friendship from Hemming, King of the Danes, mightiest ruler of this Middle Earth."
"My gratitude to the noble queen. I accept this drink in recognition of our friendship, now and in the future," said Vali. He took a sip.
"Formalities over," said Hemming, who had been preoccupied with a parchment.
He handed it back to the kneeling priest and looked up at Vali.
"Good. You are welcome, Vali of the Horda, over and above the high words with which we honour you."
The king spoke perfect Norse without a trace of an accent.
"Your Majesty is good to see me so soon after my arrival," said Vali. "All other business ceased when we knew you were here," said Hemming with a short smile.
The king then sat in silence for a moment, staring at Vali. Vali wondered if he was expected to say something, but he couldn't think what that might be, so he just kept quiet.
"Why are you here?"
"The truth."
"To ask your permission for the Rígir to attack Hárek, or for you to order him to compensate us for our loss.
Vali did not like to lie, but there was a saying, a lie to an enemy is no lie at all. Hemming was a potential enemy, so deceit was allowable, honourable even. An oath, however, well, that would be a different matter.
"That is not why you are here," said Hemming.
His manner was calm. There was no threat at all in his voice. Only the sudden restlessness of the priest gave Vali any indication that anything was wrong. The man glanced at the king and went pale. Vali remembered that, at least in word, these priests were opposed to killing, though confusingly they did eat human flesh. If someone lied in front of Forkbeard, he could expect to be given to Odin before he had the chance to tell his next one. Was Hemming similar, if with quieter manners? There was another long silence. This time Vali did feel the need to break it first.
"I am here on a fool's errand," he said.
The king raised his eyebrows, indicating that Vali should go on. Vali tried to think fast. He needed to describe his mission in a way that Hemming would find acceptable.
"I was sick as a boy," he said, "and a healer in Rogaland tended me and cured me. I vowed to her then that any service I could do her I would. Her daughter was taken in Hardik's raid, and her mother begged me to find her and free her. It is an oath I made before Odin, Lord. I had to act upon it. Forkbeard was not keen to help me find a lowly free woman's daughter. Hence, here I am, in the only transport I could muster. I am looking for a girl."
"Go home, then. An oath in front of idols and false gods means nothing," said the priest.
His accent was thick and strange. Hemming held up his hand.
"To us, father, an oath in front of a goat or a duck is worth something. A man is only a man inasmuch as he can keep his oath."
The priest remained motionless. Hemming puckered up his mouth in thought.
"Not the whole story, is it?"
"Lord?"
"Were you running towards this girl or away from Forkbeard?"
Vali smiled.
"Something of both, sir."
"Lord of wisdom, help me now," said Hemming to the rafters.
The priest smiled uncertainly. Hemming shook his head and looked Vali up and down.
"So, what am I to do with you?"
Vali said nothing.
"No, really. I want your advice. Come on. You started this mess. Let's see you get us out of it. What shall I do with you?"
"Help me find the girl."
Hemming laughed and waved the back of his hand at Vali as if to swat him away.
"She is Harik's, taken in war. And besides, I don't think she's even his to give by now.
She's been sold on."
The king didn't answer the question, but sat back and gave Vali that appraising look again.
"What do you know of sorcery, prince?"
"Very little."
"You are too modest. The Lord Odin has his intelligences, and I have mine.
Do you want me to tell you what my ravens whisper to me?" The priest shifted again.
"Anything the king wishes to tell me, it will be my honour to hear."
"You fight foes with neither spear nor sword. Mighty war bands fall before you, defeated by mobs of boys and old men. You consult gods in the mire. You miraculously escape the most secure captivity and consort with wild men and shapeshifters. Seers and wizards from the four corners of the earth look into their ponds or take to their hanging trees, and the visions they see are of the son of the wolf eating up the world. A boy escaped from some hags of the north of your country tells, as he dies, a story about a great enchantment being laid, again, for the son of the wolf." "Is that not how you are known, prince? As the son of the wolf?"
These stories are exaggerated. I am a sore disappointment to my father, I can assure you of that.
I hear that as well, said Hemming. If I believed half the seer babble, I'd hang you now and take the consequences.
He paused and seemed thoughtful, then looked straight at Vali.
Understand my problem. Your father is stricken.
Vali tried to stop the alarm registering on his face. He failed.
Yes, I know. Your mother rules in his place. That makes you very important, for the moment. If one of your cousins or uncles seizes the throne, however, it makes you less important in one way, more in another. Your value as some sort of bargaining counter drops, but I think the new king would pay well to have you returned to him, breathing or not. On the other hand, were I to give you a few ships to conquer your homeland, then a good many of your kinsmen would rally to you, and with luck, I would have another king paying me tribute from overseas, the proper oaths having been extracted. That said, I'm always interested in short-term gain. Forkbeard is keen on seeing you again. You could still be valuable there.
Vali opened his mouth to speak, but Hemming held up a hand to silence him.
What am I to do? I've enough problems to contend with without this.
He shook his head.
I'm looking for a reason to let you go, but I really can't find one.
I eat a lot, and am expensive to keep, said Vali. He tried to keep his manner light. If he had no bargaining power with the king at all, at least he could try to make him like him. Hemming smiled. The priest stood and whispered into his ear. The king listened impassively, while the queen asked Vali how he liked the mead. The priest sank back to the floor.
You are important, said Hemming. I can see that without employing seers and wizards. That's common sense. Son and heir of that prodigious killer, your father, the Horda will want you on the throne if you've got even a sliver of that old steel in you.
My priest advises me to kill you. He gestured to the man in the sackcloth, who actually coloured with embarrassment. His religion finds practitioners of Sait threatening.
Coincidentally, word from the West makes me even more inclined to kill you. Harik wants you as a gift for the northern sorcerers. That's why he came for you.
He came to plunder, said Vali.
Hardly. He must have known Forkbeard would have hidden his gold very carefully, particularly while he was away. Why go storming in, risking war with the Rigir, when there are West men who can't muster a drakkar between them not a week's sail away? Why three ships? He has near 60, you know. Well, 59 after you relieved him of one. What can you do with three? Hit and run no more. If he thinks Forkbeard is stupid enough to leave his treasure so near the shore, then he's not the Harik I know. It was people he was after. If not you, then those close to you.
That's why he went for the girl.
How could he know about her?
How do I know about you?
Hemming shrugged. Harik doesn't have a large network of spies, but he has his methods, I'm sure. No Rigir man would dishonour his lord by spying.
Yes, he would, said Hemming. Or he'll talk in drink at markets or to traders. Some with ambitions of their own will go further.
Name the traitor, and if I see him again, he will die.
Hemming shook his head.
Well, I'd hardly be likely to do that, would I?
The facts are these. Harik wanted you.
That's the word I hear. You. Which is why you become important again. I mean,
I might allow you to accept his hospitality for a consideration. On the other hand, if I do that, we all know that King Orthon has his ravens too, and your mother Irsa even more. If I hand you over to Harik, I anger your father. While I have no doubt my men could crush the Horda in war, I also have no doubt your father would make us pay a high price for the victory. He may be sick, or that may be a bluff. Whatever, I think there's a chance he would make a remarkable recovery and demonstrate his uncanny knack of finding the opposing king on the battlefield. He glanced at his bodyguard. And it would be a shame to meet such a formidable, some say unbeatable, warrior, and destroy the myth. "Kings are for glory, not long life," said Vali, repeating the well-known saying. "Your father seems to have combined both to alarming effect. It would take a brave man, though needless to say I long for such a chance to prove myself in combat against such as he. A brave man indeed, to bet on ending either. I tell you this, Orthon would let me die a thousand deaths before he gave you or Harik so much as a coin in ransom. I am not so important. He can name an heir." Hemming tapped his knee. "I disagree. You are important. Line of Odin and all that. What do you do in the far northeast?" The question surprised Vali, as it was meant to. "Nothing. I have been on one raid in the west, but nothing further." "To the land of the whale people? Vagoi, the wolf island, or around there in Ultima Thule?" Vali recognized the old name for the islands at the end of the known world. He shrugged. "What do you know of the Wolf Island?" said Hemming. "Nothing." "Harik's son was captured near there a year or so ago. I've wondered if that's anything to do with all this."
"In what way?"
Hemming shrugged in his turn. "Harik loves his son. Though why, I cannot tell. The boy's an idiot. I don't know. There's always been a rumour about the whale people keeping a vast treasure up there. Maybe he went looking for that. He's the rarest sort of fool if he has."
"Why?"
"Because the northerners are as poor as prophets. There is no treasure. I've sent men up there myself to check, but it's a flat, cold rock, nothing more. Whatever he was up there for, he's got lost, and Harik wants him back."
"But then Harik attacks the Rigir instead of going after him. It makes no sense."
Vali was nervous. He drained the mead, and the queen came forward with more. Hemming went on. "He could have you, but quite frankly, Harik went against my advice in raiding the Rigir. So I'm certainly not rewarding him with what he wants.
What to do? What to do?
I intend to find the girl I'm looking for and live as a farmer," said Vali. "I want nothing to do with kingship." Hemming snorted.
"Well, you'll find that in this life what you intend rarely has any bearing on what you finish up doing, particularly as a king. If I let you go, you'll become king or die. Whoever became king in your place wouldn't want Orthon's son hiding like a wolf in the byre. You'd be dead and your family with you within a year. Intend. Intend. I didn't intend you to come here. If you'd passed through Hythabir without proclaiming who you were, I would never have detained you. We feared attack by the townsfolk."
"Hythabir is the world's biggest port," said Hemming. "People are used to strangers. You could have come and gone as you pleased. It isn't some farmstead where you have to sound your horn as soon as you're in earshot or risk doing the dead lord's dance."
Vali felt stupid and angry. Why hadn't Forkbeard allowed him one of these holy men sitting on his shoulder, recording his orders so they couldn't be forgotten, lost, or argued about, and teaching him to speak like Hemming,
Surely it was worth kneeling to their god for that, whatever you believed in your heart.
If you release me, you have my oath of friendship.
Well, I had already considered that. I'd be something of a fool to let you leave without it, wouldn't I? Said Hemming. He smiled again at Varley. If you and your friends could contrive to die in an accident, then many of the problems this causes me would be solved, you know.
Again, Hemming's face lacked menace, though Varley could see the danger was greater than his manner suggested. He was businesslike and thoughtful.
Forkbeard would have been screaming in Varley's face or sucking up to him.
"If Your Majesty releases me, then I shall endeavour to do my best to fulfil his wishes," he said. "I intend now to go to Harrick and ask him for the girl."
Hemming laughed. "Make sure you ask him when you've got your spear halfway through him, or you've very little chance of a pleasant answer." "Anyway, Harrick didn't go home, so you won't find him there."
"Where did he go?" For the first time, Hemming seemed on the edge of anger.
"Should I tell you that, so you can hunt him down and kill him, he who swells my coffers with chests of silver and gold? If you intend to use me as your raven, Prince, the least you could do is throw me a little corn."
"I have none to give."
Hemming turned his face away.
"No," he said. "You don't, do you? Go back to your quarters. I'll decide whether to kill you, sell you, or keep you by the end of tomorrow."
He extended his hand, and the priest passed him up a piece of parchment. Queen Inga took the drinking horn from Varley's hands, and a bodyguard led him from the hall. Chapter 31 A Plan. On his way back from Hemming's hall, Varley came across Bragi and Felig, looking out at the small harbour, the wolfman seeming almost slight next to the bulk of Bragi.
"Hemming's men must have a thirst on them. Do you think we'll get any of that?"
said Bragi as Varley came to his side. On Skardi's order, the chain on the harbour wall was being lowered to allow a small squat boat containing 5 huge barrels of wine to enter. Bragi explained that the whole settlement had been talking about the delivery. A boy had arrived with a message from the town while Varley was seeing Hemming.
"Vele Slibor sends his best wishes to the king, his finest wine, a small token of thanks for all the king does for the people of Hythabir," said the messenger.
"It's an apology," said Varley.
"Right enough," said Bragi. Both men knew the real reason for Vele Slibor's generosity was that word had reached Hemming the merchant hadn't informed him of his contact with a foreign prince. It wasn't exactly a hanging offence, but neither could it be overlooked. As soon as Veles could get his hands on quality wine, he had sent it to the king to improve Hemming's deliberations on what should happen to him.
"I'll be surprised if he doesn't have to pay a lot more than that," said Bragi. "Orthon would have had his head for such a crime if he'd been in the wrong mood."
"He'd be a fool, then," said Gyrth,
the Norse-speaking retainer who had been looking after them during their stay.
"Veles is the best-connected merchant in the world. The tribute he pays the king buys many a byrnie and blade. And look, it's Styrman the Skald. Where did they get him from? Styrman! Hey, Styrman!"
A man disembarking waved his arm in the air. He was tall and thin, though with a drinker's face, and he carried a lyre under his arm, not wrapped up at all. There, thought Varley, was someone who valued his reputation as a skald more than the health of the instrument that earned him a living. Every skald he had ever met had been showy like that. They almost had to be, in order to succeed in their profession.
"Veles sent his best boat east for me," shouted the skald, "and demanded that I accompany his wine here."
"A story, a story!"
"Tonight," said the skald, "when the mead is drunk, and we are drunker."
The wine was heaved off the boat onto the foreshore, and some men began rolling the barrels up towards the king's hall, while from throughout the settlement people came to see Styrman. Vali had seen skalds before, and met a few popular ones, but this man seemed to have everyone's attention. From the shouted requests of the crowd, he could see why.
"Tell us of Ulfric the Hobbler and Ivar Horsecock!"
a young man cried out.
"We will beat you in flighting. No insult contest can you win, you who was raised so womanly."
He was laughing, but good-natured.
"I am afraid of flighting with you, young fellow. Your balls have to drop sometime, and should they do so during the duel of gibes, the noise might put me off what I have to say. Clang!"
The crowd seemed to find this hilarious, much funnier than Vali thought it was. Still, the skald was well-liked, it seemed, and if he was an expert in flighting, it would be interesting to hear him. People would come from miles around to test their wits against such a man. It was said that a good skald could best 100 opponents in an evening's drinking, each one dispatched with a different insult, usually in rhyme. Vali looked out at the chain, and then at the river beyond. The longing he felt inside didn't even come to him as words, just as a sort of hunger, an ache in his stomach. He had to find a way to get out. But even if he did escape from the settlement, Hemming would have no problem hunting him down. He would be stopped or killed by fearful farmers if he ran by land. By water the route was easier, but still perilous. The best he could manage alone was a fairing, and even that would be difficult. It was some distance to the sea, and the wind was uncertain. A drakkar would be on him before he reached the open ocean. He walked back to the gloom of the house and sat down. There was no one there for a change, not even women. Everyone had gone outside to see the skald. He picked at some boiled meat in a bowl. And then he came to his answer. The skald's performance that evening would give him his chance. But escape was not enough. He needed to do something to stop himself being pursued. If the Danes thought he was dead, then they wouldn't come after him. The wolfman was his double. He tapped a bone against the bowl and tried to think of a way around the path that had opened before him. He couldn't. Vali would have to kill Felig, dress him in his own clothes, and then make off. It wouldn't guarantee him escape. Hemming would certainly want to make a show of finding his guest's killers, but the hunt would not be nearly so enthusiastic as if he was looking for Vali himself. He worked out the details. He would need to get a Danish cloak to wrap himself in. The guards would be drunk or distracted by the skald, and Vali thought he could just walk out. The wolfman could steal a cloak. When he returned to give it to Vali, he would kill him. Vali said the words in his mind to fix himself in his purpose. "I will kill him." It was the best way, he knew. And yet, that vision kept returning. The cave, the wolfman's body bent into the shape of that strange rune, his own body and that of Adisla similarly contorted. He felt anxious. What would happen if he failed? The wolfman would kill him, and Adisla would be alone. Bragi had told him that his father Orthon was famous for cold thinking, for seeing what needed to be done and doing it without regard to emotion or affection. Was it not rumored that he had taken 9 warriors with him to the mountain witches, knowing they would die? He had needed them, so he had taken them. The wolfman was not Vali's kinsman either, but an outlaw who had killed many men. Vali had not been disarmed. That would have been a dishonor too far, and an admission that the Danes feared him. He only had to remove his sword when he entered Hemming's hall. He remembered the beach, the wolfman thrashing after him in the water, and thought that he should have let him drown. He couldn't account for what had made him risk his own life saving him. Perhaps it was fate, saving the wolfman for the greater purpose of aiding his escape, Vali thought. As the idea fixed itself in his mind, he found himself seeking justifications for what he was about to do. Felek was dangerous. He had exposed them by his actions in the town. He drew attention to them wherever they went. On top of all that, he had some attraction for Adisla that unnerved Vali. Could he trust Felek if they did find her? No. He'd seen the looks the wolfman gave him and could sense what Felek felt towards him. Felek wanted Vali dead, but he needed him to find Adisla. As soon as that was done, Vali knew Felek would attack him. "I am a wolf," the wolfman liked to say. So he needed to be treated like one. Still, Vali didn't relish what he had to do. It was, he told himself, simply his best chance. Would he include Bragi in the escape? Yes, of course. Whatever the wisdom of trying to make it alone, he couldn't kill a kinsman or abandon one to die. He had set sail to find Adisla, but he would have done the same for Bragi. He may have found the old man a bore, but he was a bore he was related to, and that solid fact removed all debate. Vali drifted off to sleep, allowing the familiar aromas of the longhouse to take him back to his childhood at Disa's hearth. He remembered Adisla and the warmth of her against him in the long winter evenings, as they'd sat listening to the old stories of how the dwarfs made treasure for the gods, or of the never-ending battle fought by the war-dead in the afterlife. There were other, better stories, too. Tales of farm life, of how Disa had tricked her husband into wiping his arse with a nettle in return for a beating he'd given her, of the funny things they'd said as children, of how the Rigir had suffered, fought, and fled before marriage and trade had brought peace, or so they thought, to their lands. To find Adisla again, to have her sit by him as they listened to stories in the night. He would kill 1,000 wolf men, skin them, and hang out their hides for the ravens to peck at. All he needed to do was wait for darkness. Chapter 32. The Wine Road. The flighting was in full session, and the Skald was doing well. A huge Jarl had shouted that Styrman was skinny, mean, and too lazy to find his own food. At least Vali thought that was what he said. He could speak good Danish. His time with Barth the Thrall had seen to that. But in the tumult of the hall, he had difficulty picking some of the words out. He heard the Skald's reply as something like, "Food scarce, Lord Tvastar, none can eat but he. Esteemed Lord, keep cloak on you as you pass the pigs, lest you be a birthing sow." The crowd roared, banging cups and knives on the table. Vali, though, could not find the contest funny. He glanced at Bragi. He had told the old man not to get drunk, but clearly Bragi had interpreted that as, "Don't get very drunk indeed." He was guffawing into his beard and shouting, "He's got you there, Faster! You asked for that one!" "How can you tell what they say?" Vali asked Bragi.
"I can't get much of it, but you know it's quality stuff from the Skald. You only have to look at the fella," said Bragi.
He was enjoying, more than enjoying, wordplay in a language he hardly understood. Vali shook his head and returned to thinking about the business of the night. The wolfman, Vali knew, was outside, sitting, as he always did in the evenings, down by the ramparts, staring into nothing. Felek couldn't stand the noise of the hall, and in company retreated into long silences, hovering between animosity and something like fear. It was fear, Vali knew, of the unfamiliar. Vali looked around at the Danish nobles, the huge hall, the rich attire of the Jarls, at their strange manners. He heard their weird ways of speaking. He was happier with ordinary people. Was he any different to Felek? Yes, he was, because he would live to see the dawn tomorrow, and Felek would not. Vali thought of the ships out on the water, symbols of the freedom he wanted. Even a rowing boat or Vele's little delivery vessel would do. He was ready. Everything had unfolded just as he had thought. The visit of the Skald was such a big occasion that the longhouses lay empty. Only a single guard sat on the perimeter wall of the harbour by the chain and another at the gate. It was going to be easier than he had imagined. Vali slipped out of the hall. It was late, and the Danes had drunk their way through four of Vele's big barrels, or at least they had been emptied. Vali knew very well that on such occasions people filled up whatever they could, and quite a lot of the wine would be transported in bottle and pan back to the longhouses to be consumed at a later date. The barrels had been upended, and the ends prized off, people filling containers by dipping them in, tied to cords if necessary, to get the last out. The push to be first to the wine had been an unedifying spectacle. He whistled to the wolfman, who turned and came towards him. Vali could sense his hatred, which was as strong as it had ever been. He was glad. It would make his task easier. "We go tonight and need cloaks," he said. "Take three from a longhouse." He had noted that everyone was in their best clothes for the visit of the Skald. Their workaday stuff would be there for the taking. "I need no cloak in this weather." "You do, for disguise. Go and get them." Soundlessly, the wolfman moved away, more like something liquid than solid, flowing from shadow to shadow. Vali steeled himself while Felek was gone. His sword was leaning against the outside of the king's hall, along with Bragi's. It would take too long to draw, though. Vali had a short knife, and thought he would do for Felek with that, as the wolfman put on his cloak. Then he would drag him to an animal pen, change their clothes, walk out of the settlement, and steal a boat as soon as he could. His nervousness made him restless, and he went back inside the hall. The Skald was causing general hilarity with his flighting, and people were queuing up to try to best him, though no one had managed it so far. They were standing on the benches, clapping and yelling, toasting and cursing him, and everyone was seriously drunk. Bragi, who was, incredibly, wearing his burnie, was proffering a drinking horn to a slave girl who was trying to fill it from a jug. He was making her task much more difficult by pulling at her dress as she did so to get a look at her breasts. "Outside," said Vali. "Now." Even though he was mildly drunk, the old warrior caught the seriousness in Vali's voice and followed him into the cool of the night. Vali took him to the shadows. "When Felek comes back," he said, "I'm going to kill him. It must be done quickly, and it must be done without sound. The best place is in the shadow of the stable over there. It's dark enough, and any noise will not be heard from the hall. It is necessary, and I'll explain why once it is done."
Bragi shrugged. "The outlaw was lucky to live so long anyway."
"Strike true. You'll be a dead man if you don't. I'll be ready, whatever."
"Yes."
They heard the Skald shouting inside the hall.
"5 tons of wine since the merchant Vele's. Only 5 little tubs to fill our bellies. Let us tell this stingy merchant, be cursed. 10 fat barrels we'll need to slake our thirst."
There was a tumult of applause and cheers inside the hall. Felek was back, with 3 old cloaks in the light Danish style.
"Over here, away from the hall, and I'll tell you the plan," said Vali.
They stepped towards the stable. Vali was very conscious of the knife in his belt. He would make Felek do up the clasp on his cloak himself. The wolfman was unused to such things, and, while his hands were occupied, Vali would stab him to the heart. Vali willed his fingers away from the knife, careful not to give his intentions away. That rune, that writhing, sinuous, shifting rune was in his head again, but he dismissed it. They reached the lee of the building, and Vali passed into the shadow. He was eager for Felek to follow, eager for it to be over. But Felek had stopped dead. He let out a low growl.
"What?" said Vali.
"There is danger here," said Felek.
His teeth came back from his lips, and he sniffed at the shadows.
"There's no danger."
"Come here," said Vali. He felt his heart pumping, and his head light with nervousness.
"I will not go there."
Vali swallowed.
"Now," he thought.
"Now!"
"Walk on, ye girl," said Bragi.
"Shh,"
said a voice from the darkness. Now Vali did draw his knife. A pale face loomed out of the shadow. It was a child, the slave boy the wolfman had released back in Heithabir.
"Please, follow," he said.
"Keep out of this, child," said Vali. Had he guessed what was on Vali's mind and was seeking to protect the man who had freed him?
"Scram," said Bragi.
He had automatically picked up his sword when he left the hall, and now he wafted it, still in its scabbard, at the boy, to swat him away.
"Veles will make you free."
"How?"
"You will go by the wine road. Follow me."
Vali thought for a moment, and then abandoned his plan. If Veles had sent this boy, then perhaps there was a better way out. The boy led them to the side of the king's hall. There were the barrels, open at the top.
"In,"
said the boy. Felek shook his head.
"No."
Bragi's hand went to his sword.
"We can just as quick kill you here," he said.
The wolfman's eyes were blank.
"Fine," said Vali. "Don't get in, and stay here to face Hemming's wrath."
"I am coming with you," said the wolfman.
"But not in there."
"There's no other way," said Vali.
There was a blast of laughter from the hall. Someone had opened the doors.
"I won't be captured again," said Felek.
The boy spoke.
"You freed me. I owe you a debt. This is not captivity, but freedom. Please, get in," he said.
There were footsteps now, drunken horseplay, voices repeating things the Skald had said, and wild laughter. The wolfman looked at the boy. He nodded, and in what seemed like a single movement, was inside a barrel. Vali got into another, but Bragi couldn't lift himself in. From Veles' boat, four men in tatty work clothes appeared. They tipped a barrel onto its side, and Bragi crawled in. Vali squeezed down as far as he could. He had just enough space to bend his knees, so his head came below the lip of the barrel.
"Stay inside,"
said a voice, and then his barrel was tipped onto its side and rolled towards the sea. The end was open, and Vali feared he would be seen, but the night was dark and everyone was drunk. The turning was nauseating, though, and it was all he could do to stop himself from falling out. At the water's edge, he felt his barrel lifted into the air and loaded onto a boat. Then a cloth was put over the top end of the barrel, and it went dark. He kept still for a while, hearing the scrapings and crashes of the other barrels being loaded next to his. How were they going to get through the chain? Hemming would never allow it to be opened at night. There was the sound of approaching shouts and many feet on the shore. The shouts became a chant.
"More wine! More wine! More wine!
Get back to your stingy master, and come back here with a gift fit for a king!"
It was the Skald, shouting from the shoreline.
"The chain opens for no one!"
It was the voice of one of the men on the boat.
"Wait till tomorrow.
You can make do with ale until then. More wine! More wine! More wine!"
The scout spoke again.
"Don't try to get out of it, you serpents. They'll open the chains soon enough if you tell them you're off on an important mission from the king himself."
"More wine! More wine! More wine!"
"Hey, Feggy! Lower the chain!" shouted a voice. "Chain down! Chain down! Chain down!" "Gladly, if the king says so."
The voice of the chain guard was very close.
"Hemming! Hemming! Grant us wine! Hemming! Hemming! Grant us wine!"
Barley felt himself shaking and cursed himself for his fear.
"Lower the chain! Never let it be said that I don't listen to the will of my people!"
It was Hemming's voice. The king had been drinking by the sound of him. Vali almost laughed. From what he had seen of Hemming, he was a serious man who wouldn't care to get too drunk. Sometimes, though, he would have to show his people he was one of them. Vali heard the oars lift, and the boat moved forward. There was the stiff clank of the lowering chain, and the boat slid out into the main channel, the crowd cheering it on. Vali regretted not killing the wolfman. It would have increased his chances of escape many times if Hemming had thought him dead. All he could hope was that Veles had come up with a better plan than he had managed himself. The journey was a long and uncomfortable one. He tried to concentrate on the rhythm of the oars to take his mind off the cramp in his legs. Then the boat stopped, and the boy whispered to Vali to keep quiet. Other men got on, and the boat began to move again. Vali guessed there had been a change of oarsmen. He was in agony now, but didn't dare move to ease his legs. He tried to sleep, but it was impossible. Eventually, when numbness had dulled the pain, he smelled the sea and saw light through the cloth draped over his barrel. The boat was still. He had to get out, he thought, or he wouldn't ever be able to move again. As he shifted, he felt a hand push him back down.
"Not long now," whispered a voice.
"Veles?"
"Your servant always, my lord."
Despite his agony, Vali gave thanks to Loki that Veles was on his side. The Obatrite was the cleverest man he had ever met. His barrel was lifted again, and Vali felt he was going to be sick. Then he was put down, on another ship as far as he could tell. He heard the barrels being lashed down and realized he must now be on an ocean-going vessel preparing for the rigors of a sea voyage. Again, Veles' voice was close by.
"As soon as we are far from the shore, you can come out. I apologize for your cramped accommodation, but be assured I had the barrels made specially for this purpose. They are commodious compared to normal vats. You will be free to stand soon."
"Thank you, Veles. You've taken great risks for me."
"Thanks are welcome, especially when princes speak with gold," said Veles.
"What will you do if Hemming finds out it was you?"
"I am the king's most valuable servant, so I doubt he'll suspect me," said Veles. "Rest assured, the blame will all be yours."
"Now be quiet. We are still inshore, and there are men close by."
Vali heard the creak of a rope and the sound of the sail taking the wind, but no one spoke. For an age he waited. He could no longer feel his legs at all, apart from his knees, which had been rubbed to rawness against the sides of the barrel. He heard a tap.
"Out!" said a voice,
and the cloth was pulled away. Vali couldn't move at all at first, but eventually managed to push himself to his feet, bending to massage the blood back into his legs. Then he climbed out of his barrel, blinded by the sun.
"Veles," said Vali, "even if I never walk properly again, I am forever in your debt. I..."
He felt a thump in his guts, so hard he puked.